Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now on to the episode. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So in last week's episode, which was episode 42, I outlined six common hormonal imbalances in our 40s or 35 plus and as we move through perimenopause. And the first one of those was declining progesterone. So that usually comes before any sort of changes to estrogen, and then the changes in estrogen that begin is usually that it gets much higher in a person than it's ever been before, as opposed to declining, like way, you know, before it starts to decline. So we get this high estrogen, then we get erratic roller coaster nature of estrogen, and eventually in the later stages of perimenopause, a person's estrogen starts its decline. But the decline of progesterone starts earlier. So that's like one of the first things, like I said. And I talked in that episode about those imbalances, how they present themselves in terms of symptoms, and then my top tips about how to support those. So go back and have a listen if you haven't already. And in this episode, I'm talking about what constitutes a healthy menstrual cycle and why ovulation is the key event, the biggest, you know, the marker really for what a healthy menstrual cycle actually is. So that's what we're going to talk about in today's episode. We're going to talk about what makes a healthy menstrual cycle, why simply having regular periods doesn't necessarily mean your cycles are doing what they should be doing, because one of the most common misconceptions or myths, I guess, about women's menstrual cycle health is that having regular periods automatically just suggests that you're ovulating each month, and it doesn't. So that's what we'll talk about today, as well as why ovulating each cycle is so important for health and goes way beyond fertility. You know, we can't just see ovulation in terms of fertility and then not care about it, unless, you know, if we're not trying to get pregnant, not care about it. We need to care about it right up until we reach menopause. Now, I learn a lot from a Canadian endocrinologist called Dr. Geraldine Pryor. So an endocrinologist is basically a medical doctor who specializes in the hormonal system of the body, so the glands and the organs that make hormones. And Dr. Pryor's work focuses on menstrual cycles and the effects of hormones on women's health. And she's an industry leader in understanding and supporting perimenopause and menopause specifically. So a lot of the information that I pass on to you, a lot of the education that I give is based on the work that I learned through her, because she is absolutely amazing in this field. So let's get into the episode then. So firstly, to say that unlike other hormonal systems in the body, like the thyroid or pancreas, which produce hormones like thyroid hormone and insulin in a relatively consistent sort of ongoing way, the menstrual cycle operates differently to those other hormonal systems in the body that release hormones. The menstrual cycle is much more sensitive to cues from our external environment and internal environment, you know, imbalances in the body, for example. And each menstrual cycle is like a whole new dance. Every month is a whole new dance choreographed by the ovaries, where a new dominant follicle gets chosen. And that's the follicle that goes on to release an egg, which is essentially ovulation. That dominant follicle drives the production of estrogen. And then that sets the stage for everything else that unfolds in that particular cycle. And it's going to vary from month to month. And since each cycle relies on the development of a brand new follicle, it's then completely normal, natural, that we see variations each cycle in maybe things like cycle length, you know, a day or two here or there, amount of estrogen that's actually produced in that one cycle, the timing of ovulation or whether it even happens at all, progesterone production and whether that happens at all, and then also PMS symptoms, period symptoms, bleeding patterns, and we'll experience variability in energy and mood-related symptoms across each cycle as well. So this explains why some months you feel pretty good and other months not so good. That could be in terms of energy, mood, motivation, and emotional regulation, and more physical symptoms like menstrual bloating, like puffiness, hot flushes or night sweating, breast tenderness, breast pain, headaches, migraines, period flow, you know, whether it's light, heavy, painful, floody, clotty, regardless of the fact that your period arrived right on time. So you could be having regular periods, but have all of these experiences be so different from cycle to cycle. So firstly, why is a healthy menstrual cycle one where we ovulate? And why do we want to ovulate every cycle? So we want to ovulate every cycle because that's how we make progesterone. No ovulation results in no progesterone. This is why ovulating halfway through every cycle is a marker of health, because a marker like health requires the production of progesterone every month as well as estrogen, not just estrogen. So we want to have that ovulation occur every month because we want to produce progesterone. And this is why I said we can't just rely on the fact that we have regular cycles to determine whether we have healthy menstrual cycles, because we can still have regular cycles and not manage, even though we haven't managed to ovulate. So basically, after ovulation, a tiny and temporary gland known as the corpus luteum gets formed and it releases progesterone. So we have it released through on that day and then every day for the remainder of our cycle until it takes a dip just before our period arrives, and then that's when we don't have any again until we next ovulate and form this corpus luteum. So if you've been listening to my podcast for a while, you'll know that progesterone is the hormone that's really important, really crucial for cycle regulation, but also good periods, so ones that aren't heavy and horrible and clotty. It's the hormone we need for mood stability, it's calming, it's anti-anxiety, it supports sleep, and it supports overall well-being. So we really want to ovulate, and it balances out estrogen. The definition of hormonal balance is estrogen in the first half of the cycle, known as the follicular phase, ovulation halfway through, followed by the production of progesterone for the second half of the cycle, known as the luteal phase, and then so on. The cycle repeats itself every month. We can also have a situation where ovulation is delayed. So we do manage to achieve it, but it's delayed. It comes later than, you know, the average sort of halfway through the cycle, or day 14, if you have a 28-day cycle, for example. It comes later, or it starts to come later than what usually happens for you. So for example, I've always, going by baseline body temperature that I was taking every morning, I've always seen a temperature spike just after day 14 of my cycle. The next morning, the temperature spike that's then sustained until I come on my period again suggests that I ovulated and made progesterone, because progesterone causes your temperature to increase a little bit. And then if you're seeing that temperature spike sustain itself until your next period, you can deduce from that basically that you did ovulate, you made progesterone, and you kept getting progesterone until the end of your cycle. And then now by the time I was age 44, I started to notice that I didn't get that temperature spike until around day 16. And then now I've stopped taking my temperature now. I was doing it for about 5-6 years and I've stopped now. But now at 45 and a half, just before I stopped doing it, I noticed that I wasn't getting that temperature spike until sometimes day 17, sometimes day 18. And then I was coming on my next period, day 25. So I was having about 7 days of a luteal phase and time with progesterone instead of a usual 2 weeks, a usual 14 days of a luteal phase and with progesterone. So that meant that for me, overall, month after month, I was having lower and lower and lower progesterone because I was making it later in the cycle. So I was having less time with it. And if I was making it later in the cycle, which I was, it probably meant I was also making much less of it than I would usually have made. So that would have affected my symptoms by way of anxiety, issues sleeping, you know, irritability, things like that, and then a heavy, heavy period with some flooding and clotting, which is exactly what I was and was experiencing. I'm managing to get a handle on that now. But yeah, so that is essentially like something that can be happening as well as we move through perimenopause is very, very normal. It's one of the reasons we have less progesterone. So even though we're maybe still ovulating some months, if the ovulation is happening later or it's incomplete or the follicle doesn't sort of develop optimally, then the formation of that corpus luteum, that temporary gland that releases progesterone, isn't as good. And then progesterone production tends to be lower. Not only that, but like I said, if we ovulation is delayed, we come on, our cycles are shorter now, we come on our next period sooner, we have less time with that low progesterone. So it's like a double whammy, if that makes sense. So if ovulation is delayed or incomplete or the follicle doesn't develop optimally, it's referred to as a low quality or suboptimal ovulation. And when that happens, then, as I said, we produce less progesterone than ideally we should. And that can leave us feeling off for the rest of the cycle. And then our PMS is more heightened that month. And then when our period arrives, it can be heavier, clottier, floodier, and so on. So what's important to understand is that ovulation isn't just an on-off switch. It's not just a matter of we did or we didn't. The quality of the ovulation really matters. If it's delayed, incomplete, or the follicle doesn't develop and release the egg properly, we have suboptimal ovulation, which means a lower amount of progesterone is made. So that's the take-home message there. So again, for example, I have some clients that when they first come to me, they'll say, I've been taking my body temperature every month and I do get a spike. So I know I'm ovulating. So I don't understand why I feel the typical symptoms of low progesterone. And then I'll explain, maybe even though you are ovulating, you're having suboptimal ovulation. So therefore you're making less progesterone and therefore you're going to have symptoms of low progesterone. So how does our external environment impact our cycles from month to month? This is all about the brain and the information that the brain is picking up from your environment. And that includes external environment and internal. So what's going on inside your body with regards to, like, for example, with health. So just as an example, if we have high blood sugar, maybe we eat a lot of sugar, a lot of refined carbohydrates, you don't eat enough protein, for example, we have high blood sugar or insulin resistance, that can impact ovulation. The brain picks up on that as something is wrong. Same way if we have low thyroid, brain is picking up on this. We're not making enough thyroid. What's going on? So that's just some examples of internal environment. External environment would be what we'll talk about in a moment, but like, you know, stresses around you, things going on around you. So the hypothalamus is a structure deep in your brain, and it's your body's smart control coordinating center. You can think of the hypothalamus as a sort of safety monitoring system that's constantly scanning your environment and asking, is it safe enough? Is this a safe enough environment to bring a baby into? Now, whilst we know that ovulation is about more than fertility, we want it so that we can make progesterone. The brain's only interest is safety for a potential egg implantation, not whether or not we make progesterone and all its wonderful hormone balancing, calming benefits. We can't, unfortunately, just say to the brain, look, we're not trying to get pregnant. We're not going to get pregnant. Don't worry. But we do want ovulation to occur. We can't obviously explain that to the brain. So your hypothalamus in the brain is always evaluating things like your nutritional status. So are you getting enough protein, good fats, quality carbohydrates, fiber, vitamins, minerals, all the lovely things that we need, particularly protein, good fats, things like zinc, vitamin D, vitamin A, vitamin E, selenium, magnesium, lots of different nutrients that we really need, all the B vitamins. It's scanning. Do we have enough of all this stuff from our nutritious meals? Do we have enough food coming in? Do we have enough calories basically coming in? Not that we're counting calories, but that's what your brain is looking at. Is this person eating three balanced meals a day, or is this person skipping meals? Are they going without breakfast? Are they fasting for too long? Are they having low fat meals, low calorie foods? That would be, the brain would think you're starving, you know, that you're under threat, you don't have enough food. So it wouldn't see it as a good environment to allow ovulation to occur. It's scanning for things like, it's evaluating inflammation. Is your body fighting any acute infections or viruses? So for example, if you were to have, you know, COVID, or particularly when COVID was really bad, if your brain picked up on this acute inflammatory response in the body because of COVID, you're very unlikely going to ovulate that month. And that certainly happened to me. I had COVID twice, and I definitely did not get a temperature spike in the the menstrual cycle that followed my, or while I was fighting the infection. And that's kind of natural, you know, but you hope that those sorts of situations are few and far between, right? You wouldn't want that more than like once a year or once in a blue moon. So it's evaluating things like that. But it's also evaluating, are you fighting small chronic fires, so known as chronic low-grade inflammation, which is really common, way more common than you think. Chronic inflammation can come from things like simply being overweight, which is inflammatory. So if we have lots of visceral fat as well, that fat that sits around our organs, around our middle, that's an inflammatory kind of active fat. Do we have any unknown chronic infection, like a low-grade chronic infection in the gut, like H. pylori or a parasite that isn't necessarily causing symptoms, but it's there and it's causing this low-grade inflammation? Could there be toxic burdens from things like environmental chemicals, parabens, microplastics? Is there a high alcoholic intake? So that's going to create chronic inflammation, high blood sugar or insulin resistance. So this is all the things that it's scanning. It's also scanning for mental and emotional stress. How much stress is this person under? How big is their life load? How balanced is it for like restorative time, you know, play time, rest time versus being constantly in survival mode? Are they always in survival mode? Fight or flight response, you know, so these are the things that the brain in your external environment and internal environment is always, always evaluating. Now, this connection between your brain and then down to your ovaries is called the HPO axis, and it stands for hypothalamic, which is in the part of the brain, pituitary, part of the brain, ovarian, your ovaries, axis, which basically means connection. So it's a connection between the brain and the ovaries where the brain is constantly evaluating your internal and external environment for any source of threats. And if it does pick up on threats, it will not communicate down as part of this axis to the ovaries. It won't tell the brain, the ovaries to ovulate. So when the brain senses that these factors I just mentioned aren't optimal, it doesn't just immediately shut everything down. It doesn't just say, right, there's no ovulation happening, but it does follow a predictable pattern to warn us of danger and attempt us to bring ourselves back to safety so that optimal ovulation can then resume. So that sort of predictable pattern of warning looks a little bit like this. So you get your first warning, which is the luteal phase, the phase of the menstrual cycle you're moved into after ovulation. That tends to become shorter. This is a gentle way of telling you that things aren't quite right. So here ovulation has happened and the corpus luteum has been formed, that little gland that releases progesterone, but it hasn't happened optimally. The formation, the ovulation wasn't optimal, and therefore the formation of the corpus luteum wasn't optimal, which is resulting in lesser amount of progesterone being made. This lesser amount of progesterone isn't robust enough to sustain a healthy or full length luteal phase. For example, you may have had a 28-day cycle. I'll use that for ease, and that's how mine were. They were always 28 days. So, and I was ovulating around day 14. So I was having about 2 weeks worth of the luteal phase, 2 weeks worth of progesterone. That would suggest that I had optimal ovulation, optimal amounts of progesterone being made from an optimal formed corpus luteum. As my cycle started to shorten in length, they went to 27 days, they went to 26 days, they're now at 25 days. That's suggestive of not having an optimal ovulation, not having an optimal formation of corpus luteum, and therefore not having enough progesterone to sustain a longer full length luteal phase. Now, this is normal natural physiology in perimenopause for someone who is 45 and a half like myself. But there are things I can do to sort of try to optimize things as much. The later I move through perimenopause, the less likely those things will still be very effective, but I might never be able to just, you know, keep my cycles at 28 days because I can't sort of fight nature, which is eventually going 12 months without a period and reaching menopause, which I will inevitably do. But I can support my body to just optimize my cycles and ovulate more months than I would have if I wasn't supporting it, and have better, more optimal ovulations and better corpus luteum formation and better progesterone production than I would have. And I believe that's what I am doing. you know, my cycles, like this month, for example, have gone to 26 days. There was just a period of time where they were like 25 days, but there was a lot of stress going on for me at that moment, at that time, for those few months. And now that that stress has alleviated a little bit, I'm noticing that this cycle and my last cycle was 26 days. So I'm having that extra day, which does make a difference with the luteal phase, so extra day of progesterone. So, you know, that's how progesterone naturally does decline in perimenopause, but we can support it. We can support that decline. We can support our ovulation to be, to actually occur and to be as optimal as it possibly can as we move through our 40s. So that's the first sort of warning. And then the final big warning, if we don't, you know, start to look at those factors I've mentioned, nutrition, you know, making sure we're eating enough, looking after our nervous system and our mental and emotional stress, looking at evaluations of any sort of inflammation that might be going on. If we haven't addressed those things and nothing is changing and the brain's like, look, you know, these stresses are just continuing or they're even getting worse, they're intensifying, that's when ovulation tends to stop completely. And then no ovulation means no progesterone at all, no luteal phase, just like one, you know, unhealthy menstrual cycle, essentially, even though your period can still arrive regularly. So that is basically the key takeaway from this is that your menstrual cycle isn't just a predictable monthly clock. It's dynamic, changing, can change, you know, month to month. It's a very intelligent system that responds to your overall health and your life circumstances, which I call a person's life load, your own, you know, unique set of circumstances, your unique stressors, responsibilities, all the things going on for you. And also that includes your, you know, your emotional mental stresses include previous traumas, for example, even from childhood. So that's the that's what makes up a person's life load, not just what's happening today, but also what's happened in the past. So having a regular period might suggest that your body's ticking along, absolutely, but true menstrual health depends on ovulation. And for ovulation to happen consistently and robustly, your body needs to feel safe. Your brain needs to pick up on this, on safety, nourishment, and balance. So it's completely normal for the body to produce less progesterone as it moves through perimenopause. You know, that gradual decline is part of the natural hormonal transition, as I said. And eventually, as we reach menopause itself, you know, once we have gone 12 months without a period, then the ovaries at that point have stopped producing both estrogen and progesterone, and we're now menopause, and then we're postmenopause from the next day. That's inevitable. Like I said, we can't defy that, but that doesn't mean that you're powerless or you should simply accept feeling worse because you've got low progesterone. The fact is, the truth is, you can support your body to ovulate more often, more effectively than it might have done on its own without intervening. And by doing that, you help maintain healthier levels of progesterone for longer and feel, you know, better for longer. This is one of the most effective ways to reduce or even prevent so many of the common symptoms of perimenopause. We can really minimize them. I still believe that I know my symptoms and experiences at 45 and a half would be different, very different, negatively different, if I wasn't in this career, for example, because obviously I do genuinely live and breathe everything I teach and educate on and suggest my clients to do. Obviously, I'm not perfect. Nobody is. But I definitely do, walk the talk. Yes, I definitely do walk the talk. And I know that if I didn't walk the talk, I would be in a different situation at 45 and a half, physically, mentally, and emotionally, and sleep. You know, things like sleep wise, for example, and my ability to train in the gym, my ability to maintain my weight, all of these things would be very, very different if I wasn't doing the things that I teach, which I'll talk about in a minute. You've got far more power than what you've been led to believe. And by supporting ovulation, you can make the transition through perimenopause all of these years smoother, more balanced, and just so much easier. So let's now talk about six ways that we can support ovulation in perimenopause. The first one has to be, and always is, manage stress, support your nervous system, minimize the impact of stress on your nervous system, basically. This is a big one. Chronic stress is one of the biggest blockers to ovulation. So if we have, I've kind of touched on, if we have like a just random one-off months in our life, or a couple of months or a couple of weeks or whatever, where something big has happened. Like it could be, for example, like physically, it would be a COVID infection and you're acutely temporarily fighting off an infection, then your brain's just like, well, okay, we're not going to do anything right now. We're just going to focus on fighting off a COVID infection. We're not worried about ovulation. That's not life, you know, that's not life sustaining. So it's fine. But that would be a one-off scenario. Or if you have a one-off major stressor. So like when we moved from London down to Margate, that was a really, really massive life change, not to mention the massive move physically, like packing up 12 years worth of a life in London and bringing it to Margate and unpacking it here and like settling into a new home in a completely new area that, you know, I've never, ever even that been to for more than a few days before, and after spending 45 years of my life in one place. So that was a massive stressor for me. And I definitely noticed shifts in my PMS, my periods, you know, my moods, my symptoms, my energy and stuff for the first sort of 8 weeks that we were here. It's only now that I'm starting to sort of come back to myself. So there's like one-off stressors that will impact us, but they should just be few and far between and one-off. But then we have the situation of chronic stress, chronic like over life load. Even things like social stress is really big these days. Saying yes all the time when you actually want to say no. Being out and about socially when you just need to go inwards and have some space. Having all your weekends taken up by social events because, again, you just keep saying yes when actually you'd like to say no, I'm not free that weekend. You know, being that person who, because you've got some free time, instead of telling people, no, I'm actually unavailable, you say, I'm not doing anything. So they see that as an invitation for you to, you know, be able to say yes to them. And you just don't want to say no because you don't want to offend anyone. Like these kind of, this sort of social stress these days is really becoming more and more of an issue for so many women. And particularly with like family commitments and things like that, they just don't want to say, they're just sort of scared to say no. And it's huge. Or even with work, you know, work, social events, things like that, you just don't want to say no. So that's a really big one these days, being able to multitask, being able to, and being available 24/7 on WhatsApp, on text, on email, on social media DMs, on everything, instant messenger within your work systems, teams, whatever it might be, is really, really stressful because we're just available. We feel like we should be available 24/7 is what I'm trying to say. So remember I said your brain is constantly scanning your environment for signs of safety or danger, and not just for you, but for that potential pregnancy, whether you're trying or not. As I said, we can't just tell our brain, don't worry about all this social stress. I'm not trying to get pregnant. I just want to ovulate so I can make progesterone. It doesn't matter. The brain is hardwired for this safety sort of mechanism. And then, so, you know, that includes other day-to-day stresses as well, like working long hours, financial worries, relationship tensions, caring for aging parents, teenage dramas, younger children, older children, running late, always being stuck in traffic, even endless scrolling can be perceived by the brain as a threat. And when your brain senses anything like this, which is danger to it, to your brain, it usually suppresses ovulation by not sending those necessary hormonal signals down to the ovaries. And of course, no ovulation means no progesterone, or it does send those signals down. It's just not as a robust ovulation and corpus luteum formation as it could have been if that stress wasn't there, right? So before the brain actually says, right, no ovulation, like remember I said, it's sort of sending this initial warning, which is like, you're still ovulating, but it's not as good. It's not as robust as it should have been. The quality of that ovulation is not as good. And therefore, we don't make as much progesterone. And we have this shorter luteal phase. So we have less time with this small amount of progesterone we've made. So clues here would be bad PMS, menstrual bloating, puffiness, mood swings before our period, irritability, anxiety, sleep issues. And then when our period comes, heavy, painful, clotty, right? These are your clues that there was no progesterone or not enough progesterone made. But the good news is that supporting our stress response, supporting our nervous system every day in small, really effective ways, simple ways, can go a long way in protecting ovulation and overall hormone health. So try incorporating things like deep breathing, just a very simple 4-6 breathing routine. I really love it. So simple. I've mentioned it before. even just for 3 minutes every morning and evening. So when you wake in the morning, sit on the end of your bed or just sit up in bed or even stay lying down and put one hand on your belly, one hand on your heart and just breathe in to a count of four through your nose, through your belly with your mouth closed, and then breathe out to a count of six, again, through the belly, mouth closed, through the nose and belly. And continue that for about 3 minutes, maybe 5 minutes if you can. And then do that at the end of the day as well. Incorporating that every day can be really, really powerful. There's also the 4-7-8. So you breathe out, breathe into a count of four, you hold to a count of seven, breathe out to a count of six, eight. It's the longer out breath that signals to the brain safety. So that's why I quite like the 4-6. Like I don't really need the 4-7-8. The 4-6 works really well. It's the longer out breath that is really signaling safety to the brain. Getting out in nature mindfully, any nature or green space, even just for 10 minutes at a time, really helpful. When I say mindful, I mean tune into what you see around you in nature, tune into the sounds that you're hearing in nature rather than just putting in some headphones or being on the phone or staring down at your phone. The amount of people I see walking around the most beautiful nature spots and they're just head down on their phones as they walk. It's kind of pointless. Like you want to be there and actually soak it in, like tell, you know, show your brain and nervous system, this is safe, this is lovely. Being in nature has been shown to support the stress response and cortisol. Gentle movement like yoga, tai chi, qigong, even just for 10 minutes at a time. Gratitude practice morning and evening. This one's really helpful. It's very difficult to have any sort of negative sort of fear-based feelings and thoughts sent to the brain when we're experiencing gratitude. So literally just thinking or saying or writing things that you're grateful for in your day, in your life, every morning and every night can take you 2 seconds. Yoga nidra, so that's also known as NSDR, non-sleep deep rest, is a guided meditation where you're lying down either on a yoga mat or on a bed, or just on a blanket on the floor, and it's like a body scan guided meditation from head to toe all around the body. And that has scientific evidence behind it, particularly if you look it up as NSDR, non-sleep deep rest, to support that it can support the nervous system and reduce the stress response and help regulate cortisol. Lying on the floor with your legs up the wall, this is just called legs up the wall pose. You might have done it in yoga before, but simply just doing that yourself, just at home, right, I'm going to lie on the floor, put my legs up the wall. Or if you don't have an actual wall space, you can just put your legs on the sofa. So rest your legs up on the sofa and lay on the floor that way. Doing that for 5 to 10 minutes a day while breathing, like your 4-6 breathing routine, that's been shown to be very helpful as well. Epsom salts baths with, to get magnesium soaked in through the skin and support relaxation and a good night's sleep. Make sure you're doing it in dim lighting, not like overhead bathroom lights. So all of these things just incorporated for your week. They're very simple. They're very short. Just weave them in to your week, to your day, not just once a week. Weave them into every day. In fact, after this episode, I'm going to lie on the floor with my legs up the wall for 5 minutes. I promise myself I would do that. The second one is to support your thyroid health. So as we move through perimenopause, we become more vulnerable to thyroid dysfunction, which I've talked about in previous episodes. So do have a look through for the specific one I've done on thyroid health. And that thyroid dysfunction can disrupt ovulation and worsen symptoms of estrogen dominance because we don't have, we're not making progesterone. So thyroid is really, really important for thyroid health is very important for optimal ovulation. So it's important that annually now, as we move through our 40s, we're getting a comprehensive thyroid check, at least, that includes TSH, free T4. So if you go to your GP, you'll usually only get TSH and free T4, but we want to also include free T3 because the thyroid hormone, the original thyroid hormone is T4. But then once the gland has made that T4, that T4 needs to get converted, which doesn't happen inside the gland, it happens in tissues in the body, it gets converted into T3, which is the active thyroid hormone that does all the active jobs. So there's no point just knowing what your T4 is. You need to know, is that T4 being converted into T3 or not? So TSH, free T4, free T3, and also thyroid antibodies known as TPO antibodies and thyroglobulin TG antibodies. Those are important to know as well, because someone may have an underactive thyroid as a result of antibodies against their thyroid gland, which is known as Hashimoto's. And if you don't know that, then you're not going to address that. You're just going to be addressing the fact that you've got low thyroid hormone and doing all of these things to support that without actually supporting the underlying cause, which is these antibodies. So that is a full thyroid check that should be done once a year. I do this with my clients through private thyroid testing. It's relatively inexpensive. Some of them can ask their GP for these 4-5 markers, and they do get lucky and they say yes. If not, it's relatively inexpensive to do it privately. And I do, yeah, like I said, I do that with most of my clients to double check things are okay. MediChecks is also a good sort of DIY option. Some of my clients do it through MediChecks and then they send me the results and we go through them together. So yeah, poor thyroid function will suppress ovulation and contribute to those horrible PMS symptoms, fatigue, heavy periods, mood changes. So staying on top of it is really important. And then the third one is the third way to support ovulation and progesterone is to prevent or reverse insulin resistance. I talked about this in the previous episode. I've also got separate episodes on insulin sensitivity, insulin resistance itself, and blood sugar balance. But the main point here is that blood sugar balance is foundational for hormone health. If you haven't picked up on that already from my episodes. And when insulin resistance sets in, it disrupts ovulation and fuels symptoms like PMS, heavy bleeding, energy crashes, and brain fog, brain fatigue, because insulin resistance means that we can't efficiently get energy into the brain. So you can support insulin sensitivity by eating blood sugar balancing meals. So that's 3 square meals a day with 30 to 40 grams of protein, a couple of servings of different healthy fats, and you know, things like avocado, nuts, seeds, olive oil, flaxseed, different seeds, coconut milk, coconut oil, full fat stuff, plenty of fiber rich carbohydrates. So the slow release carbohydrates, like just a fistful serving of like sweet potato or baby new potatoes or quinoa or brown rice, for example, beans, lentils, and getting plenty of colorful vegetables, dark leafy greens and all the colors. Avoiding frequent snacking, so ideally eating 3 square meals, maybe one in between lunch and dinner that's protein based, so 3.5 meals, I like to say. Having a 12 to 14 hour fast overnight. I would avoid a 16 hour fast for most women. This doesn't apply to everybody, so before anyone says, you know, that's not fair, I do it and it works for me. For most women going through perimenopause, in our modern world, fasting for 16 hours overnight can be problematic and, you know, cause issues. And one example I will give, because it can just be too much stress on the adrenal glands. And then when we're skipping that first meal of the day and wait until sort of 11, 12 o'clock to eat, by then the adrenals have crashed. You know, the adrenals have, the stress response have kicked in, I should say, from the adrenals, and they've released stress hormones. And now blood sugar has crashed. And you know, the stress hormones are rife, so that's not helpful. And actually, I'll give an example of where this, you know, something that happened a few months ago. I was giving a women's health talk to a corporate client, and there was like loads of women on this call, and then there was a Q&A at the end, and I had said during the presentation why, you know, fasting for 16 hours might not work for everybody and can make symptoms worse. And at the end, the Q&A, one of the women on the call, she said, I'm 48 or something, it was 47, 48, and I've been fasting for 16 hours, like for years now, and it works for me. And I said, that's great. As long as it works for you and you don't have any symptoms, you know, your weight is okay, you don't have increased stubborn belly fat that you can't get rid of, you don't have brain fog, low energy, sleep issues, you know, your energy is nice throughout the day, then it's obviously working for you. And she said, oh, I have all of those symptoms and I have stubborn belly fat. So I said, okay, so it's not working for you. It's fine. If it works for you, it means you don't have symptoms. You feel good. You feel balanced. You wake up every day feeling refreshed. You don't have trouble sleeping, falling asleep, staying asleep. You don't have fatigue. You don't have stubborn belly fat. You know, you don't have irritability and anxiety. You feel good. If it works for you, you feel good. She said it worked for her until we dug into, you know, the symptoms. And she said, oh, actually, I do have all of those symptoms. I said, well, try reducing your fast to 14 hours maximum overnight. And she said, yes, I will do that. And I have not heard from her since, but I'm sure that probably helps a lot, because it usually does. Just reducing it down to 14 hours maximum overnight usually works wonders for women who have been fasting for longer. The other thing that's really helpful for insulin sensitivity is strength training, you know, lifting weights 2 to 3 times a week for 30 to 45 minutes. It's really, really helpful for supporting insulin sensitivity, reversing or preventing insulin resistance. So this, think of supporting insulin sensitivity as metabolic groundwork for healthy, regular ovulation and an easier perimenopause. The fourth way to support ovulation is to eat, of course, a nourishing, balanced diet that has enough energy, enough calories. Perimenopause is not a time for calorie restriction or fad diets. Never was, actually. But after 35, we definitely cannot. We're not supporting our body if we're on calorie restricted diets and fad diets. Absolutely not. Ovulation, and especially the formation of the corpus luteum, that structure that makes progesterone after ovulation, requires energy and nutrients. So that means consistent nourishing meals with enough food to meet your body's needs. That is literally what it means. So we want to focus on protein at every meal, at least 30 grams, ideally from animal sources, or at least including animal sources, or, you know, a good mix of a variety of different fish, poultry. Ideally good quality, if budget allows, really good quality grass-fed organic red meat. And then, you know, all the other types of protein that we can get in as well. Good quality sheep's cheese. So any sort of cheeses made ideally from goats and sheep cheeses, which are not inflammatory to the body like cow's milk can be. Eggs, beans, legumes, you know, beans and pulses, edamame beans, tofu, tempeh, and just mixing all of these different sources of protein together throughout the week. You can use good quality unflavored protein powder as well in smoothies, for example, to help you meet your requirements. Slow release carbohydrates like root vegetables, oats, quinoa, beans, lentils, brown rice, and so on. Healthy fats for hormone production. So again, that's things like avocado, coconut oil, extra virgin olive oil, flax oil, nuts, seeds, oily fish as well, things like salmon, mackerel, sardines, herring, trout, really, really important healthy fats to be focusing on. Colourful vegetables, dark green leafy veg, all the purples, reds, oranges, yellows, etc., for antioxidants and fibre. And then key nutrients like cholesterol, which would come from, say, egg yolks, prawns, for example. We need dietary cholesterol in order to help us make progesterone in the first place. It's a raw material for its production. We need B vitamins, particularly folate, B6, B12. We need CoQ10, which we can get from animal foods. We need vitamin D, so important to get your levels tested. Go to your GP, or you can use something like MediCheck, where it's about £40 to do a finger prick test at home and see what your levels are. Iodine, magnesium, selenium, zinc, these all come from, you know, just making sure we have a very well-rounded, nutritious, nutrient-dense diet. We don't want to skip meals. So remember, as I just mentioned, you know, fasting until late morning or lunchtime and undereating will work against your hormone health completely. You may think you can do like a quick weight loss, you know, diet for 3 months or something, and maybe you'll lose weight, but most of that won't come from body fat. It will come from muscle, it will come from water, and it will just come back on again anyway. But one of the worst things it will do is it will have this detrimental impact on ovulation. Your brain sees that as a threat. Identify and address underlying issues, anything underlying health issues. Sometimes ovulation is disrupted not by age alone, but by hidden sources of chronic inflammation or deeper imbalances. So these can interfere with the follicle development and progesterone production, the corpus luteum formation. So common underlying issues that we need to consider would be that we have an autoimmune condition. So, for example, having Hashimoto's, which is thyroid autoimmunity. That's why those two thyroid antibodies are really important to be checking on when we do a thyroid check. We could have unknown food sensitivities to things like gluten or the A1 protein found in cow's milk. That's why I really like to focus on cheese that's made from sheep and or goat's milk. So I like to get Manchego cheese, which is sheep's cheese, and my feta cheese, or if I get halloumi, I always make sure I read the label and pick the one that's specifically made from sheep and goat's milk, not cow's milk. So that can be a hidden food sensitivity. And really the best way to figure out if you've got a food sensitivity is to give something up one thing at a time. Don't just do, if you suspect two or three things, you want to do it one at a time. So you give it up for 2 weeks and see how you feel, and then slowly bring it back in very gradually and see if symptoms come back. That's the most effective way to test for food sensitivities. You may have something known as leaky gut, intestinal permeability, which I've talked about on previous episodes. There's a gut health episode, I think in the title it says leaky gut or intestinal permeability. We may have infections in the gut. So like I mentioned, it could be H. pylori that's unknown, gone undetected. It could be parasites that aren't specifically causing any like bad symptoms. You know, we might think diarrhea and vomiting, but we don't necessarily need to have those symptoms to have a chronic parasite infection. We might have yeast, like candida yeast overgrowth. It could be mold infections as well, that have gone in, that colonized into the gut. So from living in a moldy environment, for example, ongoing viral infections undetected, like Epstein-Barr virus or HPV. And we could have type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance as well. So all of these things would be these common underlying issues that would be hindering ovulation. So if basically making the sort of nutrition and lifestyle changes that I've mentioned, like stress support, improving your diet, doesn't sort of help things, then it may be time to sort of dig deeper with functional testing and personalized support. And that's why a lot of my one-to-one clients end up coming to me, because they have made a lot of changes, but they've only got so far. They do feel better, but they know that they could feel so much better, and they should feel so much better from the changes they've made. So then they think, okay, there could be something else going on here, and I just need personalized support. So if you do want to talk with me and having a free discovery call, you can use the link in the show notes, or just go to my website, francescaliparotti.com, and book in with me for a free chat, and we'll see what's going on for you and how I could help, and see if we're a good fit to work together. And then the final thing I want to say about supporting ovulation is considering the use of Vitex chase tree berry supplement. So this won't work for everyone, and some research suggests that it would only be helpful in the earlier stages of perimenopause, so maybe like late 30s, early 40s, particularly when your periods are still regular. Some research says that once your periods become irregular, you're skipping periods, you know, you're sort of more on your way to eventually going 12 months without a period, even though it could be years away. That could be a time where Vitex won't really touch the sides, you know, but when periods are still regular, you're just in the earlier stages of perimenopause, it can be helpful. I used it from 40 to 45. I stopped it recently, basically, because I think I'm just at that stage now where it's not really doing much. But Vitex is known as Vitex agnus castus, also known as chaste berry. It's a herbal remedy traditionally used to support hormone balance and healthy ovulation. It works by gently influencing the brain's hormonal signaling. So it supports luteinizing hormone production from the brain signaling, and it calms FSH, so follicle stimulating hormone, which can encourage more regular and robust ovulation. Vitex might also help with nervous system regulation as well. So it'd be a lovely added benefit that it supports nervous system regulation and symptoms like breast tenderness, bloating and irritability. You know, anything that supports nervous system regulation will support ovulation to occur better. So in terms of how to use Vitex, you would take it in the morning. So you could buy it in like capsule form, for example. You'd usually take it in like maybe one or two capsules. You know, you just read the label depending on how much is in that particular supplement in each capsule, how many milligrams of Vitex. You take it in the morning. That's when the brain is most responsive. So you don't have to eat. You can take it first thing. You start around day 6 of your cycle. So once you're on day 6 of basically, you know, day 5 of your bleed, day 6 of your cycle, you then start it and you continue taking it until your period comes again. When your period comes again, day 1 of your next period, you break until again day 6, and so on. So you take this 5-day break, this 5-day pause at the start of each new cycle before resuming it again. And that helps to sort of reduce the effects of it from attenuating. Like it prevents the effects of Vitex from just being like the body just getting used to it and it not actually having any effect anymore. That little break is really helpful for that. You want to use it consistently for 3 to 6 months before you would make a decision about whether it's helping or not. If it is helping, you know, continue, but maybe take a little break after about 6 or 7 months, take a break for a month and then go back to it again, just to prevent the effects of it from attenuating. Vitex works best alongside everything else I've mentioned here. It's a supportive tool. It's not a standalone solution. You have to use it alongside making really good nutrition and lifestyle changes. So I hope this has been helpful to help you understand what is a healthy menstrual cycle, why a healthy menstrual cycle means one where you ovulated, and how ovulation is a marker of health in general. It's like a fifth vital sign. Is it fifth or sixth? I can't remember how many vital signs they are. Had a bit of brain fog. I think it's fifth. So I think we'd say it was like the fifth vital sign, basically, if we ovulate. And we can, like, even though it's natural that we ovulate less and less robustly as we go through perimenopause, we can support it for as long as possible so that we ovulate for, you know, as many months as we possibly can until our body gets to that point where it's just not going to do it anymore and we hit menopause. So I hope this has been helpful and insightful. Any questions, any comments, anything you want to know about, anything you want me to address on a future episode, just drop me a line. I'd love to hear from you. I really, really love getting emails from my listeners, whether it's just a comment about how something has helped them, or whether it's a question, maybe something didn't make sense, or you felt it was, you know, you just didn't understand it. I love getting emails from you all. And of course, I love getting questions. I love you saying, please, can you address this on a future episode and give me a bit of a backstory? I really love that. And of course, I'll keep you completely anonymous on the episode. So you can email me at Francesca@francescaliparotti.com. You'll also find my email address in the show notes. And you can send me a DM on Instagram as well, if you're on Instagram. And I'd love to hear from you. So thanks for listening and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye. If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.